Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.
You are locked on Warriors, your daily Golden State Warriors podcast. I am Danny Lurie, your host, so happy to bring you your team every day. And considering the Warriors have games on Friday and Saturday, I am taking the Your Team Every Day a little bit stronger than usual. And I really want to do a podcast, even before the game happened, on tonight's Warriors-Celtics game from Boston Garden. And the person I wanted to talk with is somebody I've known for a while, Jared Weiss. He writes for Celtics blog, and he covers the Celtics. He does the Garden Report post-game show for CLNS Radio. And I wanted somebody who was in the building, and that ended up being even a better idea considering how everything went. So we talked about the Warriors' dominant third quarter, what players he thought looked good, and a whole lot else. Conversation runs about 35 minutes. And then after that, I didn't want to do it while he was on the air because it was so late when he was in Boston. But I wanted to talk a little bit about my issues with Coach Kerr's, let's call it, injury mitigation management at the end of blowout games like this. And so I have a little bit of a, let's call it a little bit of a conversation towards the end of that. So that'll be after the 35 minutes, but I hope you really enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on.
It is good to be here this late at night in Boston after that absolute massacre.
Yeah, that's one of the funny things kind of about doing this with you and I, because I stayed on the West Coast, I didn't go on this trip, is that, yeah, you've had this long day, and I basically just sat at home the whole time. But I feel like the place that we have to start is that third quarter, and you were there, you were in the Garden. What was the feeling in the building when that was going down?
I mean, there were audible groans. I was actually sitting in this like weird section where they put a media table in the middle of the section. So I'm just surrounded by fans just booing. People were starting to fight each other between Durant supporters and Celtic supporters. And whatever was going on in the stands didn't matter. It was watching Durant just absolutely carve them to pieces along with Klay Thompson, who moved off the ball like a graceful Russian ballerina tonight. I mean, it was just beautiful to watch. But Durant, you could just see in that third quarter, he just wanted to be the power guy, the way he was going on the boards, the way he was moving the ball. He just wanted to really just feel the control of the game. And it worked so beautifully.
Well, yeah, he was so active in that stretch. I mean, one of the big criticisms of the Warriors, despite all their success, is that they have had these weird passive moments where just kind of, well, actually the fourth quarter was another one of these, where it just kind of feels like they're doing what they need to win, but they're not really doing it. In that third quarter, what was so definitive to me was that they wanted it. For whatever reason, I don't know if it was something triggered them or if they just realized, we can take this now. They just engaged fully and absolutely dominated.
Well, I talked to Zaza Pachulia before the game about his legendary Game 6 speech against the Celtics when he was at Atlanta back in 2008. And something tells me he gave another one of those speeches at halftime, because the amount of fire that they came out there with, they went on, was it a 24-3 run in the first half of that quarter?
Yep.
The Celtics, like, they're in this position right now where they're without their two guys in the front court that really kind of set the tone for them at each end. I mean, Crowder is that guy on defense that sets the tone. Horford is the connective tissue for them on offense, even though they've barely even had a chance to experience that so far. But in the small samples we've seen of Horford playing in that starting lineup of theirs, I mean, it's very apparent that he's the glue that makes it all work. And they didn't have it. The Celtics had two very distinctly separate sides of the floor when they were on offense, and trying to get them to connect was extremely difficult, and they were mostly relying on one-on-three drives and stuff like that. And really, Isaiah Thomas is trying to force transition when it wasn't even there. But on the other side, and also credit to the Warriors, who were just so physical defending, like side pick and rolls. We saw Sean Livingston just smother people. James McAdoo actually had some really good defensive performances in the third quarter. But physically on both ends, the Warriors completely manhandled the Celtics. And at a certain point, it wasn't really about analyzing execution. It was really just about the fact that the Warriors were playing with commitment and conviction and were physically just intimidating the Celtics.
what struck me early in the game was that the Warriors were still ahead when they were missing a lot of shots that they normally make. It was the same thing that I thought in the third quarter of the Raptors game, though in that game they already had the lead. And so I'm just sitting there going, this often can head in one of two directions with this team this year. One is that they just kind of stay in that floaty mode and, you know, they'll probably win, but just not win by much. And then the other one was they'll start making those shots and this game's going to get ugly. I didn't expect what happened, but that concept was there for me when I saw the shots they were getting in the first half.
Well, I mean, their strategy seems to be get through the game with staggering two stars at a time. And we saw that, but then they have the third quarter when they're coming out there and they have everybody out there together. And I think the question for the Warriors team this year is going to be, are they going to bury teams early in the second half when they have all four guys out there at the same time? And tonight was one of those nights where a lot of it because of the matchup where we had both also Marcus Smart getting knocked out of this game, which, I mean, who knows how big of an impact that was. I don't think it would have made a difference in the end, but obviously they're going against a team without Crowder and Horford. But the Warriors, we could see a lot of it could be a lot like what Curry had when he wasn't playing in the fourth quarter, because we can see a lot of games where they're just burying teams halfway through the third quarter. And then I know this is something you're not happy about, is whether Steph Curry will actually even play in the fourth quarter, and Durant kind of the same boat there.
Kerr deserves a lot of credit in prior years for kind of having certain moments where he would pull Curry specifically. That was an issue in mine. I'm gonna kind of save that for after you, because it's late enough there. It's almost 1 o'clock a.m. I'm gonna save that for after. But
hey, I wanted to just tee you up just in case you wanted to go off. But
that's gonna be like a 10-minute conversation with my listeners
with yourself.
And so yeah, with myself too. But so I think one of the elements of this game that was interesting that it continued was the idea that has been kind of at the one of the hallmarks this year that wasn't in prior years, is the idea of the regular season as a laboratory. And in this game, it was James Michael McAdoo. You know, McAdoo mm-hmm. hasn't played in a while, and he hasn't played meaningful minutes to off the top of my head the entire season. And then all of a sudden, he's the guy off the bench in the first quarter. And, you know, I don't think he looked great. He had a couple of nice possessions, but the Warriors are just kind of sitting there going, oh, this is a close game against a team that played us well twice last year, including beating them at Oracle. Eh, we're fine with it.
Yeah, and McAdoo, I'm just looking up how many minutes he's played so far this year. He's only played in four games, and he only played 9 minutes against Portland, and then like 7 minutes against the Thunder, and 4 minutes against the Lakers and Dallas in each of those games. So he's basically not at all part of the roster, or I'm sorry, the rotation. But I think tonight was a matchup where you could put him in there, because the Celtics had Jordan Mickey out there, who's like a really similar kind of player, even if they play a little bit differently. But like same kind of thing, where he's like a guy that like you don't think is going to be able to physically conduct himself in the game, but you have to throw him out there at some point. I thought it was a great experiment for them to try, especially when you're in a game where you're up so much. That's kind of that's when you want to see what kind of lineup they're out there. And I mean, they're going to need McAdoo. They know they're going to get to a situation in the playoffs where they're going to count on him. It happened last year. It's going to happen again this year, especially because defense in the low post is going to be an issue depth wise for this team at some point. The Celtics are having it way worse of a problem than the Warriors are right now. And a team can only, as someone that watches the Celtics play every single day, a team can only count on their perimeter activeness so much over the course of the season. At a certain point, your perimeter defense is going to have holes in it, because guys are just can't keep up throughout the game. They can't be physical throughout the game, and you need people that can stuff the lane high. One thing that I think was huge for the Warriors running away with it in this game was that whenever the Celtics were able to get through the perimeter, they were met with a stone wall like 10 feet from the basket. They could not get anywhere near the hoop. It got to a point where guys like Avery Bradley were throwing up like floaters from 8 feet out, which are shots that he literally never takes. I've watched every minute Avery Bradley's played in his career, and I've seen him take that shot maybe 6 times. So that's the stuff that the Warriors need to be able to do, is when guys like Clay, when guys like Andre aren't able to put a stone wall up front, they need a second wall behind it. And seeing if you can do that early in the year with guys like McAdoo is really important.
That's a really good point. And it gets to the idea of how there are different kinds of defensive success. And the ideal in many ways is to have different stages. And so it's kind of like if you want to think about it as like a video game, you know, you get past the first one and then there's something else that you have to deal with and you have to get past that. And so the idea being that if you have to get through that many levels of defense, not only does it increase the possibility of a turnover, but it just also makes it a lot harder. It's a lot more strenuous. It usually burns more shot clock. And the Warriors haven't done that for the most part this year. They've given up too much on pick and rolls. They've given up too much guard penetration. And at moments, they've done a good job of rim protection. But that secondary coverage was a key component last year, and more importantly, 2 years ago, that has been pretty absent this year. But to see it, even if it was against a, let's call it a diminished Celtics team, it was still a good sign.
I mean, in the third quarter, the Celtics couldn't get a shot off from pretty much anywhere. And just looking at like their shot zones, everything was just, they were on the 3-point line because they couldn't break through. And then they had a few plays where some of their post guys were able to get shots off and near the hoop, but they couldn't get anywhere near the mid range. They couldn't get anywhere near the high post. It was either just it was really just mostly broken plays where they would settle for three. And I'm actually wondering, is Draymond Green more Bowser or more Ganondorf from the Zelda series?
I haven't played much Zelda since the NES days, so I'm still gonna say that though, because Bowser looks intimidating but doesn't really do a whole lot. He doesn't in terms of that. But yeah, looking at the, I wanted to go back to the Boston shot chart thing. So in that stretch of the first 6.5 minutes of the third quarter, the Celtics only took three shots that were even close to the basket. All the rest were pretty far away, and yeah, that's incredible. You know, like that they had two shots at the restricted area and actually missed both of those.
Yep.
Then made one, then attempted one in the paint, and the only one they made was that above the break three by that was Isaiah?
Isaiah, yeah. And all the threes are above the break. They couldn't get anywhere. They can't even get to the sides against the Warriors. I mean, the Warriors just they trap you in this like circular zone around the top of the key, and you can't function with the ball anywhere else, because there were some plays where I think they would get like Jaylen Brown or Gerald Green the ball in like the left corner, and they would make it. They would start to advance on the baseline, and then someone would show up on a rotation like high baseline. Then they would throw it back out towards the top of the key, rotation right there to smother it again. And they would eventually, the Celtics would just over and over be taking kind of contested threes on a rush catch and shoot from the top of the key, and they weren't going in tonight.
So something I always enjoy asking, as this is a Warrior-centric podcast, but having on people who don't watch the team, who watch other teams, is asking them about players that, you know, Warriors fans have watched a lot and have their own opinions on. And so the guy I want to start with is Patrick McCaw. What did you think of him in this game?
I think he might be the skinniest person I've ever seen in my life. And despite that, he still manages to get to the rim. It's really impressive. I mean, we didn't get to see a ton of him tonight, right? But I liked what I saw. I mean, he got 16 good minutes in there. I mean, I like the fact that the Warriors have done a good job of just keeping active guys in the rotation. I mean, Ian Clark didn't play nearly as much as I thought he would tonight, but he just impresses you with his level of activity. And of course, I thought Livingston was phenomenal. Even though he had a minus 12 plus minus, I thought his defense was just so great when they were really running away with it. I mean, honestly, McCaw, I haven't seen that much of him. Tonight was, I probably watched him play about 30 minutes so far in total. But I feel like he's like the next Bazemore Clark kind of guy, where he's like, people are probably laughing at him that see him occasionally for a year or two. And then all of a sudden he's like a useful rotation player.
That the Bazemore one is actually a really fair comparison, just with the idea of what they can do well and what they can't. And the sad thing is that Bazemore came along at the Warriors at a time that they didn't really know how to use him. And if they had him now, they would do a much better job with it, kind of like what the Hawks have done. But Livingston has been in this strange place this year, and I agree with you on how he played tonight, because his offensive role has changed so dramatically because of the stagger, because it went from being that he was basically like one of the central pieces of the offense of the second unit to being, you know, still important, but not being the guy, because Kevin Durant is often the guy. And what has been impressive over the last couple of games, it's been a change that I've noticed, is that he's really engaging defensively. And that's kind of how he's countering this, is, you know, he's picking his spots offensively because he really does have to, and then being more aggressive defensively. And playing him with different guys, I think, has helped that out. You know, it's a little bit easier to do that sort of thing when you're playing with a guy like Patrick McCaw than when you're playing with Barbosa, who while a good player in many ways, just he didn't fit the mold of really their kind of attacking system, and now they have personnel that they can basically just do that when they want to.
Well, I mean, two things about Livingston with McCaw is that McCaw, one, he can advance the ball passing well. He's like the kind of guy that he'll like. I like how he can like drive to the free throw line while someone else is rolling and then slip them a pocket pass. And he can also, you can put him in the corner and he can do catch and shoot from the corner. So having another passer out there is really crucial because they can go with both Livingston and McCaw out there at the same time and still have everybody be able to pass, which is so crucial for them. And with Livingston, I feel like last year his greatest advantage would be when they could give him like ISO post-ups against other point guards and kind of work out of the post-up. And I don't know, I don't think they're doing that as much this year. We didn't really see any of it tonight. But he is making up for it with his defense. I mean, he was coming like he if a guy would get by him on a rotation, he would force him into a trap by like the block and then block him from behind. He had one, I think, Marcus Smart or Isaiah Thomas? He might have blocked from behind.
I think it was Smart, but I'm not sure.
Is it Smart? Okay, but he's committed, and that's what's great. Yeah. Is they need him to be committed throughout the play on defense if that's going to be his role this year. And I mean, there's one thing we know about Livingston is he's the guy that's going to take his assignment. He's going to excel with it. He's not, you know, he's not going to be a great all around player, but he's going to have the two or three things he's going to do well. And I mean, you tell me, has he been rebounding at the same rate that he was last year? Because that was probably his biggest trait last year. I mean, tonight he only had two rebounds, but he had two blocks.
I think it's been a little bit less, but he's done a good job. You know, it's one of the. I think it's more about circumstances. Also, you're playing him. They're bouncing around the lineups a little bit, so it's changing in that way. Another guy I wanted to ask you about because you have a lot more familiarity with him was it weird to see David West primarily playing center considering all the time you've seen him at the four?
I know, right? I mean, it was just weird to see David West. Period. Honestly, and like to see him wearing yellow, but it wasn't the Pacers. Well, the thing was, I was thinking, how is he at the five? Their lineup is going to be screwed with him at the five. And then he made a really good defensive play. I can't remember exactly what it was. I think it was the block he had in the game. But I think the bottom line with the Warriors is that anyone playing under Steve Kerr can do anything, especially when they're next to guys like Draymond and Durant who are doing absolutely everything out there. So that takes a lot of pressure off. If you can put out West next to Durant, I think Durant's playing defense at a level right now that allows you to have West in the pivot and Durant can still make up for it. So, I mean, they had seven blocks tonight. So it's like, I mean, I haven't looked at the actual like defensive on-ball defensive numbers for the post yet, but the fact that that pretty much everybody is contributing to shot altering is a very strong sign that their second unit can mix and match defensively and still get away with it.
West is struggling a little bit in the things that are a lot harder for a slower guy to do, like when he gets out on a guy on a switch and when he's in a pick and roll where he has to recover. But that gets into the idea that you were talking about with Durant, of that if you use him with Durant, then you can have him be the rim protector in some of those. I think they have to just build an awareness that that is a structural weakness. It's also more of a regular season thing because we'll see what West's role is. I'm guessing it'll be similar to when he was on the Spurs, where, you know, he has a kind of a central, not a central spot, but, you know, a useful, reliable spot in the rotation the regular season, and then that largely gets marginalized in the playoffs, and I think he's pretty much okay with that. But, you know, he's getting better at knowing what he needs to do out there, and he did have those flaws. Like, I think it was once he got switched on to Terry Rozier, and Rozier just smoked him. And that's what you'd expect. You know, like, as much as you want to say, oh, well, you know, David West and this limitation, it's like, yeah, you put David West in his mid-30s on a point guard who's athletic and can dribble. Like, the Celtics have this weird thing where they have all these guys that have flaws, but pretty much everybody on that team can dribble. And so it puts the Warriors into some spots because they're so switch happy when they're on that they're like, oh, whatever, we'll just make it work. And sometimes they can't, but they can in the playoffs because they won't be using the guys who struggle in that way.
And that's something that Boston's been doing a lot this year to try to make up for some offensive kind of like downturns for them, is they've been working really hard to force switches onto Isaiah or Marcus Smart where they get a big on him that's slow footed and then they attack. We saw Isaiah do that a lot tonight. Although that's how he got to the line, because he had 9 free throw attempts in the game tonight. Although it was actually a really, really high paced game tonight. There were a ton of possessions or very few free throws. But so the Celtics, I think they are looking at the Warriors and they're thinking, our attack against the Warriors is just to keep doing DHOs, keep getting switches until we have our matchup and try to go one-on-one and build out of that. So I think they pulled Zaza onto Isaiah a few times. Marcus got McAdoo a couple times and West a couple times. So I think that worked, and that was one of the ways that the Celtics had tried to stem the bleeding. Obviously, it didn't work overall tonight until the fourth quarter when Jaylen Brown got in there and made some noise, and Isaiah came back in and made some noise. But over the course of a series, not going to work on Golden State unless you're just raining it from downtown, which we'll see if Boston can do that. But it looks like the Clippers and the Cavs are probably the only teams that could really give it a shot at this point. But I guess at a certain point, it doesn't matter because Golden State's rotations on defense are so physically aggressive, they're so well communicated, and they're so reliable that even when the Celtics would get guys like Zaza onto an island on a switch, Durant would fly over and stuff the drive, or Draymond is in there, he'll fly over and stuff the drive. I didn't see anything that worked tonight. Like, there's no solution. The Warriors, they're just so perfectly run that no matter what weakness you can try to pick apart on them, everybody else just steps up to cover it up.
Everything that you just said is exactly why many people, including myself, have gone a little bit crazy when this team has not defended well, because you're sitting there going, you have everything you want. You know, like, it's not necessarily perfect personnel every second of every game, especially because Curry hasn't engaged defensively like he has at moments in other years, and the big men aren't as stout, let's say, as Bogut and Azili were last year. But they have these moments where it's like, oh yeah, this is how it's going to work. And remembering that this season is insanely long, like, it is 5 months from now until the playoffs, and it already feels like this season's been going on a while. You know, like the playoffs start almost exactly 5 months from today. And so it's like, okay, basically the Warriors are just killing time. Like, that is what this season is. And there have been moments in the last two games in particular, I would say, like putting in McAdoo, and there were some things against the Raptors where it felt vaguely disrespectful to the game, where it's like, yeah, we're just going to do whatever we feel like and we'll win anyway. And that's the kind of the crazy thing. Like, Pop does... And I think we might actually see this from the Warriors against the Bucks tomorrow. But Pop does the thing about, like, oh, we're going to put in all our bench guys, and the bench guys often lose those games, even after they nearly beat the Heat, which I think about that game sometimes, about how the Spurs backups nearly beat Miami.
But, one of the greatest regular season games in NBA history,
which I was watching from the media room at Oracle when they had already announced that Pop was going to get fined. And so, really? Like, the entire press corps at the Warriors game was rooting for the Spurs out of spite. Just because, like, if they won, it would be hilarious. And so the Warriors haven't really done that. They've done more of, like, the in-game tinkering. And that actually makes more sense with their personnel and the uncertainty. Because the Spurs' difference was that they knew what they had. And they were so good that they didn't need to prove it. This Warriors team is in the information-gathering mode still. They need to know who works with who fits in, whether this guy can actually play or not. And it leads to these awkward things where they have played lineups that sometimes don't mesh perfectly or that are imperfect, but they're still winning. It's crazy.
They completely carved out this massive hole for Durant, and they're trying to figure out, as all the dirt and sand rushes back in, what are the things that are getting in that they want to spit back out. So you bring in Durant, and Durant is playing really good defense for the most part all of a sudden. He hasn't really done that most of his career. So the question is, and you would know this better, is he playing really good defense because he's on a team that's well coached, and he's on a team where, how can I say this right, the players seem to actually want to work together really well? Or is it just that he's gotten to this point in his career, or is it that he's just trying really hard right now because it's new and he wants to prove his point and all that kind of stuff? So right now, I think Durant's defensive performance is covering up what could be some major holes. The Celtics are kind of on the flip side right now, where because they have so little, because there's so many guys that are injured right now and their core is so depleted, their huge holes are being exposed really early. To the point that there are people commenting on my articles and tweeting me saying, should the Celtics trade Tyler Zeller in a second round pick for Andrew Bogut this week? in order to fix the rebounding problems, which I think, along with what Draymond Green...
Actually, if that were on the table, they probably should do it just because Zeller's not providing much value, and what do they need another second-round pick for? But
There's no question they should do that trade. Just why on earth would the Mavs trade that for a second-round pick and a guy they're going to cut? So, like, it's a ridiculous trade. But I wouldn't be surprised if they traded for Andrew Bogut at some point, but they're probably going to have to give up, like, a first-round pick or something like that. They're not going to get away with a second-round pick.
Yeah, there is a hilarious thing on that. I've had Warriors fans talk to me about how they could get Boga back, and there's this weird thing that the Warriors cannot get him if he gets cut, but they can trade for him, but they just don't have the assets to make that happen because they would have to give up so much salary, because it's not like they have trade exceptions sitting around.
Ah, oh, but don't you want James Michael McAdoo in Dallas so badly?
I want Anderson Varejao somewhere else badly, but that's a little bit different.
Hey, it was nice to run into Anderson. His hair is always entertaining.
He's a really nice guy. Like that, it's one of the hardest things about being really critical about somebody. And, you know, I don't deal with Anderson very much, but it's like all of my criticism is him as a basketball player. It's not anything else, but he's just not good anymore.
Yeah, he's like the anti-Jeff Green. It's like it's all about just his capability on the court now, nothing to do with what's in the head. But just getting back to the Durant thing, and you answer this for me because this is more fun for me than it is for our listeners. But do you see Durant's defensive performance? Is it as good as it appears from the outside? And is this something that you think will actually last through the season? And more so, is it going to really last in the playoffs?
It won't last in the regular season because it hasn't already. He's very floaty in terms of when he cares, but it really does feel like the booing helps. Like it helps motivate him and everything else. But
he got a lot of it tonight. He did. It really helped tonight.
And when he's on, he's on. Like that was something what I saw in the that was more in the Spurs series than the Warriors series. But when he's on, he's just a train wreck out there in a good way. You know, like he destroys offenses, and he can do that. And especially with Draymond out there, he doesn't have to shoulder the same kind of load. He can be more of like a freelance guy, and Draymond's more the rock, and then he's just kind of the guy flying around doing whatever he needs to do, which is kind of paralleling what the Thunder did last year with Serge. And he has those moments where like, oh yeah, that's still in him, but it has been fairly sporadic during the regular season. And something that has been kind of, I don't know the right way of putting it, but it's like let's call it a barometer of the season, is that when Durant is engaged defensively, that's when the Warriors are at their best defensively. And that's not a surprise because he is he plays closer to the rim, he's more important, and he has an incredibly high defensive ceiling. So it would make sense that the team would, on that end, would ebb and flow with him, whereas on the offensive end, he's so consistent that he doesn't provide the variance on the team. It's guys like Klay that do.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that just begs the question, when they're having defensive issues, are they going to take Durant off the floor? I mean, assuming he's the cause for it, or are they going to...
I don't think he's... I'll clarify that. I don't think he's the cause of it. I think that he's just not cleaning up what he could. So okay. I've described Andrew Bogut before as being one of the best guys in the league, and this is still true, at cleaning up other people's mistakes. And so that is something very different from causing mistakes yourself. Like, you know, and Durant sometimes does that. Like it happened in the Olympics too, where he would just like fall asleep at the switch and get beat back door. That happens with the Warriors too every once in a while. But what he's best at is not that like Kawhi Leonard enveloping a guy, that sort of thing. It's more the Serge Ibaka role, Serge Ibaka's stereotypical role is when he plays power forward next to a center, which is somebody else makes a mistake and he prevents that from even becoming a shot in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And he does that from time to time, and he will in the playoffs, I assume, but it is not a regular occurrence, partially because expecting him to do that so frequently is just irrational considering the structure of this team and their place in the overall NBA.
Yeah, and also just their transition frequency just kind of like takes away a lot of the defensive issues overall, sure. Right? Because it just on the aggregate throughout the game, whenever they're starting to get bogged down in half-court defense and the pace slows down, boom, they explode for a quick fast break. And we saw tonight with Durant now, because Durant's one of the great transition players in the history of the game. And I feel like they've always been really good in transition, but they never had the one guy that was completely just unstoppable in transition. But now with Durant, I mean, you add that to what they were already doing last year. Them in transition reminds me a lot of the 2012 or 2013 Heat. where they just every single time the ball just starts moving the opposite direction, you just like you have someone down there is ready to jump over whoever's covering them. And the level of explosiveness is just unbelievable. The defenses always are backpedaling, and it's and the emotional energy that comes out of it just completely swings the momentum of the game.
The other reason that parallel works is because of one of the big changes between Durant and Barnes is that Durant is such a better dribbler and passer. So what Miami was able to do was they could basically say, okay, whoever gets the ball, whether it be that they rebound it or the guy who receives the outlet, is going to make a good decision with it. And with Miami, it was actually a little bit easier because very few of their transition threats were reliable shooters. So it was basically just run to the basket, throw the ball high, and hope that LeBron or Wade or whoever else catches it. With the Warriors, it has to be more complicated. And this is actually why Klay kind of struggles as a passer in transition, because the Warriors don't run fast breaks in the same way everybody else does, because they have guys like Curry and Klay that can just stop and just shoot from there. And so you, as an offensive player, you have to approach it differently. And a guy who's actually embraced this already is Patrick McCaw. McCaw understands that if he knows who's on the floor, he's like, okay, well, so if Durant's coming, he's going to run straight to the basket. Draymond's going to kind of do a couple different things. Curry and Klay are probably going to try to pull up above the break. And he's able to know, okay, they're going to do that. And the guy who really started that understanding, which is what makes the Warriors a different level transition team, is Iguodala. Iguodala kind of has an understanding of where every guy wants the ball in those circumstances and has allowed them to work with that expectation as opposed to every other team that just crashes the rim. And yeah, they do really well. I mean, getting free throws, getting to the line, all that. And that's what Durant can do. And what makes KD so crazy is he can do both of those things and be the passer. So basically he can fill any role on their transition offense.
And what I like is, especially when Iggy has the ball on in transition, I feel like he tries to do change of pace while he's in transition, which very few guys ever do. It's usually it's just a race to the finish. But with him, he'll attack, then slow down at half court, then attack again, just to be able to create some sort of defensive confusion to open up the weak side elbow for Klay, who's coming down in delayed transition, stuff like that. And they run their transition plays look more like half court sets than any other modern team I've ever seen.
They also look more like half court sets than many of the things they run in the half court.
It's just
one of the ways that this team is really crazy. And I feel like they're more comfortable in terms of running their offense that way than they are in the half court. And that's another thing that will come with time, because you have to, because you're not going to get as many transition looks once it gets to the playoffs. But as I said, it's about 5 months to figure all that out. Anything else from this game that stood out to you?
I mean, just kind of hammering the point we just said, I'm covering the Celtics, and they were coming into this when assuming Horford and Crowder are healthy, where they were kind of looking a lot like how the Warriors looked a couple years ago when they were starting up, especially because Avery Bradley has been so phenomenal until tonight, I guess, throughout the year, although he was pretty good tonight.
He was pretty good tonight.
Yeah, he's probably going to make the All-Star team at this rate. Obviously, it's way too early, but he's been playing fantastic. I think tonight was a great reminder as someone that watches the Celtics, the gulf, and this is what I wrote about in my story, the gulf between a team trying to become the Warriors style and then who the Warriors actually are. And I mean, and as incredible as the Warriors are with adding Durant, they were so good last year that you're still seeing a very comparable level of dominance. It's just that they have it's with Durant now, it's mostly just being able to dig yourself out of a hole so quickly, where like Durant, there was a like kind of a lag period in the third quarter, and then Durant's like, screw this, we're getting out of this, and then boom boom, and they're back up by 30 points. And you can see that while Isaiah Thomas is kind of starting to be able to become that player, and he's really ascending to that all NBA level so far this year, the Celtics don't have that ability to just completely reverse things reverse momentum right out of a slump on offense. At least on defense, they were able to last year. We'll see if they can once they get fully healthy. But it was really just fascinating to see the dichotomy between a team becoming a really good team and then like a truly great team. And it's something that when you're covering any team besides the Warriors, you just or the Cavs, I guess, you don't really get to see very often.
It's a thing that's that watching the whole league has made me appreciate a lot more than I would if I focused as much on the Warriors as, you know, many people who cover this team do. Because I watch, you know, like I was watching Raptors Nuggets tonight after the Warriors game ended. And it was And it was just sloggy. I mean, the Raptors have some really great moments. So do the Nuggets. The Nuggets have had some nice moments this year. But
they're overall so hard to watch.
Right. And so you see that and you're like, oh, okay, yeah, what I'm seeing day to day is really special. And the other part with the Warriors that's incredibly unusual this year and even different than last year is that last year there were maybe one or two different combinations of five guys that could dig the Warriors out of a hole, that could really go on that run. This year, even with the stagger, it feels like it can come from anywhere. And it often does come at the beginning of that third quarter or the, you know, kind of there are a couple different little moments. One that ends up being really good for the Warriors sometimes is the last 2 minutes of the first quarter, because oftentimes they bring Durant in and Curry and Draymond are still on the floor. And sometimes they just run people then. But they have these moments. But then when you think about it, they're like, well, when we get to May, those moments are going to be most of the game. You know, like they're basically just the stagger is a construct to keep everybody fresh, to keep everybody motivated. That's not going to be a problem. And so then you think, oh, like what are they going to be then? But I've been able to now, especially with this road trip, incidentally, appreciate this for what it is while thinking about what that will be.
Well, I can tell you, I know, was it Chris Bosch was the one that was saying that the Heat made a mistake their first year giving into the villain identity and that it took them over. I don't think that's a problem for the Warriors right now. Just looking at the fire and the defensive intensity that they're playing with, they came into a hostile environment where they knew that they were getting booed. They knew that Kevin was getting booed. They knew that Draymond was getting booed, and they the way they fed off of it, just like I'm telling you, Zaza Pachulia probably slapped each person in the face individually at halftime. I don't know what it took, but they came out like they had smelling salts under, like tied to their mouth the entire time. It was incredible, and to be able to play with that level of just like fire is extremely rare. No other team in the league can do it besides Cleveland, and I guess the Clippers can do it right now, but they can make teams question themselves and question if they have what it takes. And that's something that when you're able to put another team in that position and then you gut them right then, you bury them. And we saw the Warriors buried the Celtics in this game when halfway through the third quarter, Jordan Mickey saw the ball get swung to Zaza Pachulia at 18 feet, and he started to charge out on them. He's like, no, I need him to take this shot. This is the only thing that we could possibly have as a good outcome for us. And then Zaza just buried the shot and spanked his booty, and that was it. And the game was completely over at that point, regardless of what happened in the fourth quarter.
I have nothing to add. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks, man.
Thanks to Jared for taking the time. You can read him at Celtics Blog. You can listen to the Garden Report postgame show on CLNS Radio. You can also listen to his new podcast. He's doing a narrative podcast called The Garden Report, and you can check that out. The first episode is on Gerald Green. Pretty cool. And then you can also follow him on Twitter at Jared Weiss NBA. That's JaredWeiss NBA. And as promised, I want to talk a little bit about Coach Kerr and his management of things. And so the basic premise of this is that he needs to be ready to basically know when a game is over and to be confident enough in the non-starters to let it salt away. And that goes in a couple of different directions. So the one that most people focus on for a good reason is the personnel. And so there is no good reason, especially once we got to the second half of the fourth quarter, but even at the beginning of the fourth quarter, to have starters and key contributors in a 30-point game with 12 minutes to go. It is incredibly hard for a team like that to come back, and more importantly, you're putting miles on the tires and potential injury risk on players without a good reason. And so what you do in those circumstances is a couple of different things. So one is the Warriors are inhibited by the fact that they have so many big men that they can't really put out a true garbage player lineup, a garbage time lineup more accurately. So that is a little bit of a problem. You know, that's when they've run into the issues with Kevon Looney at the three and everything else. So maybe you need one guy like a Sean Livingston or Iguodala or somebody to be the stabilizing force. If that's what it takes, it's okay. I would prefer that they avoid that and can tolerate it with the Clark, McCaw, Looney, McGee, and then whatever the other guy is in this game was James Michael McAdoo with those lineups. But it is also about the approach. And so when a team is up by that much, really what they need to do offensively is make sure they're running the clock, so make sure they're not turning it over. Sometimes the other team is going to trap, so you want to be sure that you can get out of that and just don't get yourself in those kind of situations, which, if that is really your entire structural goal, it's doable. It's not the easiest thing, considering you have limited personnel, but you can still do that. And no matter what, you should take at least 20 seconds on every possession. And some people have talked about the idea of doing it with the shot clock violation, but the easier thing to do is just put the ball up and hope that it hits the rim. And maybe you send one guy up for the glass. Like if you're playing Kevon Looney, you can have Looney go up there, because if he fights on the glass, not only does that keep at least one, in this case, Celtics defender back there, but also, you know, if he gets the rebound, then you have another 24 seconds. So you just do that. And then no matter what, you contest everything that the other team does, ideally without fouling. And then they're going to use about 10 seconds each way. So if you assume at least 30 seconds for each Celtic shot, even if you're not making very much, you should be absolutely fine. And the reason it matters, beyond the obvious, is because every second of players out there, they're running into injury risk. And if you watch, you know, like those minutes, even if it was, you know, not as much in terms of the outcome being in doubt, players were putting themselves at risk. I think Durant went into the cameras at one point with that. When you're contesting shots, you can get on a guy's foot. That is in some ways similar to how Steph Curry's hurt his ankle a few times. And even if it's a low risk, it's a low risk repeated a series of different times, because they're NBA players. They're trying when they're out there. And also, the reason it matters is because if you go with that sort of an approach, if you need to bring back your starters, they're all there. It's not like they're going to, you're putting them, it's like baseball where once you pull them from the game, they can't come back in. So I wouldn't say you like put them on ice or anything like that, but you don't plan on it. And so going to that approach of just killing time, making sure you don't turn the ball over, the other team will also kind of take that lead. And generally speaking, they're not going to fight it too hard. But when you have starters out there that are basically trying not to get hurt and that are trying a little bit, you know, all that sort of thing, you actually get yourself into more trouble because the other team is going to push a little bit harder. They're going to get more chances. And the most important part of that in this game, and it varies based on the contest, was the passage of time. The Warriors were shooting a fair amount with David West had a couple, Curry had a couple, Durant had one, where they were shooting with like 10 to 14 seconds left on the shot clock. And most of the time they were good shots. But if your goal is basically to choke the life out of the other team, you don't want to give them that kind of an out. And so really what this requires is just a very different approach to that, and the willingness to win a game ugly, but win a game and avoid the risk of injury. Also, if you do it right, if you want to get a little bit more ambitious with it, in those last 10 seconds of the shot clock, the Warriors can try some stuff. You know, you can try some pick and rolls. You can do everything like that. It's not just about throwing up a piece of garbage at the end of the clock. It's about the mentality of not turning the ball over and making sure that you use as much time as you can. That does not mean every look has to be a bad look. And if they go to that approach, even sometimes, you know, just they'll get a layup or two off of it, but it's a way that good teams can salt away games, and it's something that has been frustrating for the Warriors for all of Kerr's tenure, partially because there were a couple games early on. There was one against the Suns, which I believe Clay was out for. I think that was when Clay was in the Bahamas because of a family thing, that the Warriors blew a lead, and it was an issue. They had one last year where they came really, really close to blowing, I think it was like a 10-point lead with a couple minutes to go. And sure, part of that was about the backups not being as good, especially last year. But some of it was also just that they weren't really trained on what to do in that, and taking bad shots, rushing in, and everything else like that, and not taking the defensive approach necessary to stop everything you can is what leads to an opponent scoring 10 points in 2 minutes or something like that, you know, I think that was in like a minute 15. So the Warriors do not need that to be their design imperative. It is not the most important thing for them to do. But when you are a team that is going to be participating in as many blowouts as the Warriors expect, knowing how to manage that is exceedingly important. And it would be terrible for the season to be changed in some way, and maybe even a guy's career, because these minutes were not managed correctly. When the game is already settled, you know, maybe there's a 1 in 100 chance that the other team comes back, to do it that way. And it's not easy. I'm not saying it's anything like that. And of course the starters want to play and everything like that. You have to make some hard decisions, and you have to do some real training to make sure that the guys who are basically your garbage time guys know what to do. But it is certainly possible. And over the next couple weeks, it would be a great sign to start to see some of that stuff in play, because the Warriors have too much on the line to handle guys like Stephen Curry and Kevin Durant, but even, you know, Andre Iguodala being out there in moments when the outcome is not in doubt. So that is something they should work on, and hopefully they do. Thank you so much to everybody for listening. I will be doing another podcast after the Bucks game tomorrow. I really do enjoy doing these post-game ones, and it was weird to have this much to talk about, but that's the way it happens sometimes. And so that podcast will come out, you know, probably around this time the next day on, you know, so Saturday night, Sunday morning, depending on how you're thinking about all this. And then I'm planning on doing another podcast on Monday, but we'll see. I mean, it is really going to depend and on interest, but I also know that Sundays are kind of a dead time, so maybe I will give that a little bit of time to breathe. So if you have any feedback, good, bad, and different, you can reach out to me at Danny LaRue on Twitter or DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com. You can also support the show by downloading every episode, subscribing, leaving a rating, leaving a review, and checking out our sponsors. They didn't advertise on this one, but it's still worth promoting. SeatGeek, you download the free app. It's a great app. You use the promo code LOWARRIORS, and you get $20 off your first purchase. And then Mack Weldon, which was a new sponsor on yesterday's episode, or on the most recent episode, it was 2 days ago. You go to MackWeldon.com, and then you use the promo code LOW for Locked On Warriors. So you use the promo code LOW, and you get 20% off your first order. So $20 in one way, 20% the other way. Two great products I've used personally myself and enjoy quite a bit. So thank you so much for listening. Take care, and make it a great day.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.